It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Police and riot gear storming New York's Columbia University, clearing out anti-Israel protesters, and violence erupts at anti-Israel demonstrations at UCLA. The latest on this on the Fox News Radio Hourly Newscast and at foxnews.com.
I'm Tyrus.
I'm Liz Klayman.
I'm Greg Jarrett, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. I'm Lisa Brady. Protests escalate on college campuses, testing the limits of free speech, and in some cases, crossing a line.
There needs to be a lesson drawn by many of these young people that acts like this have consequences, and we haven't seen too many consequences yet.
I'm Dave Anthony. A plan to ban a type of cigarette has been put in the ashtray for now. And here's why that worries a former U.S. Surgeon General.
We know that menthol masks the harshness of tobacco smoke and enhances nicotine addiction, and it was specifically marketed to the Black community.
And I'm Tommy Lahren. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Pro-Palestinian protesters aren't giving up at top universities across the U.S., even after tent-clearing arrests on some campuses, including at the University of Texas, Austin.
Israel is a racist state!
Though violations of school rules haven't been enough to send police in everywhere, and at Columbia University in New York City, where the first tent encampment began 2 weeks ago, protesters who smashed windows and broke into Hamilton Hall early yesterday continued to occupy the building, even after Columbia announced they would be expelled. That building takeover happened hours after the school set a deadline and threatened suspensions for protesters in tents.
We regret that protesters have chosen to escalate the situation through their actions.
But just as he said Columbia is following through on consequences, the school's vice president of communications, Ben Chang, also treaded carefully during a briefing yesterday evening.
I want to be clear. This is about responding to the actions of the protesters, not their cause.
Protesters have shared demands at multiple campuses, including amnesty for their actions and divestment from businesses tied to Israel. Many Jewish students say they don't feel safe.
Well, we are trying to be students. We are trying to take our finals.
Sarah Renbaum is a junior at George Washington University. Nick Baum, a freshman at Columbia.
And when they wave a banner that reads Intifada, I think of my own safety first and how that's been completely compromised by this obscene instigation on campus.
At many protests, it's outsiders, not just students, leading to questions about protest funding and security concerns.
Anti-Semitism is a virus, and because the administration and woke university presidents aren't stepping in, we're seeing it spread.
House Speaker Mike Johnson announcing that multiple Republican-led House committees will investigate. The White House says protests must be peaceful and lawful and that forcibly occupying buildings is wrong. But the response is being left to states and schools, which have a long history as a setting for protests.
I think they're of a piece with things we've seen before.
Former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels was president of Purdue University from 2013 to 2022.
There's a degree of, I think, people performing for each other. People have convinced themselves they're sincere about these issues. Although, as we've learned, many of them, for instance, half of the students in the initial protest didn't know what river their chant was all about. So I think there's a degree of ritual. And every so often, an issue emerges that provides an opportunity for people who I think have this mistaken idea of what going to college is all about.
Have you been surprised at all by the spread around the country?
Not really. There's a lot of imitation, as I say, goes on in these situations. I think it's been more common than not that once something flares up, others elsewhere catch the spirit, so to speak. So, no, I'm afraid we've seen this movie before. It's not one we enjoy seeing, but I guess I can't say I'm that surprised.
Is there anything that schools could have done from the beginning to prevent escalation and have better control over the situation? And I realize it, you know, it hasn't been the same on each campus in terms of the degree of control. But is there, you know, anything, you know, that should have happened in the beginning?
I want to start by saying that I try to take a somewhat charitable view toward this. These college presidents are in very difficult situations. They're not always entirely of their own making. So I'm a little careful coming to harsh judgments. I will say, however, that a few prompt expulsions that would have been therapeutic. There were some clear acts of violence, threats, and even physical harm early on. I think looking back, some of these folks wish they had acted more decisively right then. There needs to be a lesson drawn by many of these young people that acts like this have consequences, and we haven't seen too many consequences yet.
Right, and we now hear the White House kind of drawing more of a definitive line between peaceful protesting and things like, you know, taking over a building. But haven't the schools ended up kind of in a box with this, where calling in the police can escalate things, and then not calling in the police maybe hasn't worked either, because demonstrators just get more, you know, dug in with their demands? I mean, it seems at this point, at least, kind of like a no-win situation on some of these campuses for the administrations.
I'm sure in some cases that's right. But I don't think there's a substitute for drawing very clear and bright lines about what is and isn't permitted, and acting very quickly when somebody trespasses those lines. The university I served for 10 years took a very clear stance on free speech. We had virtually no limits on what someone or where someone could express themselves, provided that they didn't trespass on the rights of others. But we did not hesitate to act on those very rare occasions when someone did violate the rules. I think being clear about it and making plain that violations will not be tolerated is the best way to deter them.
How big is the issue of outsiders coming into campuses and perhaps organizing some of this? Should the schools and the White House, for instance, be paying more attention to that?
It's a very big problem. In fact, we know some of these people are paid to do or subsidized to travel around and foment difficulty of this kind. These are people who, for reasons best known to them, have decided they don't that they despise this country and are eager to express that their disdain for it in any way they can. They seize on these opportunities. You know, those people ought to go to jail. Somebody ought to press charges. And unfortunately, in many places in this country today, we have prosecutors who don't want to prosecute even worse offenses. So, I think that specifically because we know in every such case I'm aware of, there are always people outside the campus community taking part where they're discovered and apprehended doing something wrong. The consequences need to be, if anything, more severe.
Private universities can receive billions in federal funding through grants and contracts, for instance. There's one House Republican proposal that would expand the definition of anti-Semitism so that the federal government would have more of an option to cut funding under an anti-discrimination provision in the Civil Rights Act. How effective could that be, in your view?
It could be a deterrent. I'd be very careful with it. The federal government throws its weight around far too aggressively now, in many cases threatening this and that, usually involving money. And so I think any such proposal needs to be very carefully drawn so that it's not subject to abuse, as today some of the statutes, so-called anti-discrimination statutes, are stretched and frequently, I think, abused.
The U.S. Education Secretary says there are more than 100 cases open already under that Title VI anti-discrimination provision. Is that a line that's already been crossed in these protests?
I don't think there's any doubt it's been crossed. I'm not sure in exactly which instances it has or hasn't. I'm not there to see, and so I'm slow to judge, but there are no question that there have been many, many violations of both federal, but certainly state and local laws, and certainly of campus perfectly legitimate and necessary campus rules. And I do think we're seeing here, as maybe in some other contexts, a slight motion of the pendulum back in the other direction. And I'm happy to see at least a few schools promptly suspending those who have committed the most clear and egregious violations. And I would, again, I think that that's the answer really to limiting and perhaps this experience and perhaps preventing the next one.
I guess I'm just wondering, you know, how hard is it to prove a Title VI violation on a college campus? I mean, I heard one protester say, you know, don't conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. So, you know, is holding up the wrong kind of sign enough to be a Title VI violation? You know, how hard is it to prove this kind of thing?
No, you have to be careful, but there, unless the accounts we've read so frequently are all incorrect, there have been physical assaults, Jewish students called names and physically threatened when they weren't actually injured. That's pretty clearly something other than anti-Zionism.
I know there's been some parallels drawn between what's happening right now at Columbia with the takeover of Hamilton Hall and when that happened back in the 1960s, same building being taken over by protesters. Is it very different in your view, though, or is it only different in terms of how it's being handled?
I don't recall it being handled very effectively then either. You know, it's ironic that these young people are paying all this money to schools because of what they don't know. In my own view, those who decide that this is the way they want to spend their college experience are disdainful of rules that, of which they're very well aware and which are very justified. Really, some other student was deprived of that spot when the violator was admitted to Columbia or any other school. And, you know, I wouldn't hesitate at all to make that spot available to a student who really wants to come and take advantage of this wonderful opportunity these universities do provide.
USC already canceled its main stage commencement, though it has emphasized diploma ceremonies and many other events will still be happening. But, you know, the students who aren't protesting and who may have graduations muted or celebrations limited in some way, do they have any recourse in all of this?
Well, you say the ones who are protesting, they have made a choice, I guess, of what's more important to them. But that choice should not imply the right to deprive thousands and thousands of others. And please note, even in the largest of these events, it's a small percentage, a very small percentage of the total student population. And that doesn't account for the visiting protesters that we discussed a minute ago. So it's simply not acceptable for a willful minority to violate rules that were clearly laid out for them in advance, and in so doing, to punish and deprive many others of an experience that they have earned through years of hard work and study.
Well, former Indiana governor and also Purdue University president formerly, Mitch Daniels, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lisa.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by partner and managing director of Beacon Global Strategies, Michael Allen, for a look at how foreign policy will influence, or not, the 2024 election. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcast.com.
This is Tommy Lahren with your Fox News commentary coming up.
You can still smoke them if you got them. A proposed menthol cigarette ban has been put on the back burner.
I think that's a basic, like, a human right to buy, like, the favored cigarette if they want.
Anna Yao owns the Elmsford Smoke Shop in New York, where menthol cigarettes are her store's second biggest seller. But anti-smoking advocates are disappointed after pushing for menthol cigarettes and flavored cigars to be banned.
It has a numbing and cooling effect and leads to deeper inhalation. The deeper you inhale, the more toxins and nicotine you take in.
Dr. Philip Gardner co-chairs the African American Tobacco Control Leadership Council. He says a ban would especially be beneficial for the health of black smokers who overwhelmingly favor menthol cigarettes, much more than white smokers. But some civil rights leaders oppose the ban. So Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said in a statement last week, putting a ban on hold, they need more time to make the decision. Dr. Jerome Adams thinks that's a mistake. The former U.S. Surgeon General in the Trump administration favors a ban.
I actually wrote an op-ed about this a few weeks ago with former Surgeon General under Obama, Dr. Regina Benjamin. And our concern at the time, which is even more intense now, is that this is going to cost lives, and particularly it's going to cost black lives.
Dr. Adams is now the executive director of Purdue University's Health Equity Initiatives.
More than 80% of black people who smoke use menthol cigarettes, compared to just 35% of the white population who smokes. We know that menthol masks the harshness of tobacco smoke and enhances nicotine addiction, and it was specifically marketed to the black community. And so a failure to remove these products from the market is actually going to very specifically harm black communities.
We can't obviously see tobacco ads on television. They're not on the radio. You know, we don't see as much advertising. How were they so successful in marketing menthol so that they have so many more users of the product in the black community?
Well, it's a great question. And if you look back at the tobacco playbook, they were in magazines that were specifically targeted to the black community. They were in stores that were specifically in the black community. They were even made less expensive, menthol, because, again, less addictive on TV commercials and beyond. And like you said, you don't see this anymore, particularly if you aren't in these communities, because we're in a better place with cigarettes. We absolutely are. It used to be that 42% of people in America smoked in 1964. Today, less than 12% do. But again, we know certain communities, Native Americans, African Americans, the LGBTQ community, all smoke at higher rates and smoke menthol cigarettes at higher rates. And it's the biggest preventable cause of disease and death in this country still.
Now, I know that part of the strategy behind the ban of menthol would be to improve what are considered disparate health outcomes, black versus white.
Correct.
I was reading National Review. They put something out, and they said that, like many anti-racist arguments, this one is more racist than you think. Not being able to ban a product in general, but settling for banning the version of it popular with black people, doesn't put very much faith in the decision-making abilities of black people, who are fully capable of evaluating their decisions just like anyone else. So they're taking the side of, we don't need the ban necessarily.
It's interesting, because here's what that counter argument misses. It misses the fact that menthol is the only flavor that is still currently allowed amongst tobacco. Literally all other flavored products have been banned by the FDA. And so menthol is the only characterizing flavor that's still allowed. So it's not that we're removing a product specifically because we're paying attention to denying black people choice. It's that that's the only dangerous product, when you look at flavors, that's still allowed on the market. It's actually the converse. It's saying, why are we only letting something stay on the market that specifically harms a certain group of people?
So why hold off on this? If you and someone from the Obama administration agree, and so many people fear the health situation for black Americans who are smoking menthol cigarettes, why delay this?
You always run into a tension when health goes up against economics. And the tobacco industry is a big part of the U.S. economy. They have a strong lobby. As a matter of fact, they have reached out to and supported members of the black community, including Al Sharpton, who receives funding from the tobacco industry. And so you've seen him out there arguing for a delay. And I think that puts the Biden administration, to be fair to them, in a tough situation. When you have someone like Al Sharpton
out there saying that we should delay this ban. But what I will tell you is the health experts, the people who make no money off of the tobacco industry, will tell you this will save lives. It will specifically save Black and brown and LGBTQ and young lives, because again, younger people favor menthol cigarettes and flavors. And it will save us money when you look at the fact that healthcare is 20% of our GDP and costs more in the United States than anywhere else on the planet. And a lot of that cost is being driven by smoking.
Let's get into cigarette alternatives. There have been people who want vaping bans. There is certainly less science on what vaping does to us than smoking. Smoking's been around a lot longer than vaping. What's your view on e-cigarettes?
Again, many people will know that I put out a call to action and advisory warning about rising use of e-cigarettes when I was Surgeon General back in 2017. Fortunately, youth use has come down. I do believe that vaping products can be less harmful than combustible tobacco products if you are substituting one for the other.
Okay.
However, they're not less harmful if you're a young person who otherwise would not have consumed them at all. You're just giving them something that's more dangerous than not consuming nicotine. And we also know that many adults who vape don't use them as a substitute for cigarettes. They actually stack, is what we call it. They smoke in places where they can smoke combustible cigarettes, and then they vape in places where they can't smoke combustible cigarettes, and they're actually getting more nicotine and becoming more addicted. So we need more science. We need more research on who, where, when, how vaping could be a good alternative and a good means to help people quit smoking.
There's something else in the last couple of years. These little pouches, Zyn, they're like, I guess, in some ways, like the old chewing tobacco pouches,
yes.
But or snus in the last couple of years as well. But there's no tobacco in these little Zyn pouches that you put, you know, between your cheek and gum, and essentially use like chewing tobacco. There's no tobacco in it. What's the harm for Zyn?
Well, again, there's no tobacco in many of them, but there's a lot of nicotine. And nicotine in and of itself can raise your heart rate, can raise your blood pressure, can cause thinking and memory problems. And it's another one of those situations where young people are misusing them and causing real harm to themselves. And so we need to make sure we're keeping them out of the hands of young people, number one. Number two, we need to make sure we're doing the research to understand and to be able to explain to adult smokers and tobacco product users how they might be used to transition off of combustible tobacco, more dangerous combustible tobacco.
Back to menthol, do you think it's possible that after the election year, when politics aren't maybe as strong as they are now, in 2025, a menthol ban could happen for cigarettes and flavored cigars?
I really, really hate to say this because I don't want to sound cynical, but I think you've nailed it. I think that in an election year, it's really bad for a Biden campaign to get on the wrong side of the cigarette industry, to take menthol off the market and risk angering even a small section of the Black community, many of whom consume these products. But once you get past the election and the politics, everyone knows that this makes sense. I wouldn't be surprised, quite frankly, if Trump were to win, if they were to ban menthol products in a new administration, because from a health perspective, it's costing our economy, it's costing Medicare and Medicaid millions upon millions of dollars to take care of tobacco-related illness, disease, and death down the road.
You worked for former President Trump for several years. Do you want him reelected? Do you have a stake in this 2024 campaign?
Well, I think we all have an incredible stake in this campaign, and I'm going to work with either administration. I'm going to work with anyone out there who has as their goal a healthier America. I don't care about politics. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm an independent. I care about health.
Your book that came out late last year, Crisis and Chaos, Lessons from the Front Lines of the War Against COVID. It's been quite a long journey to get to where we are now.
Indeed.
What stands out to you as you looked back at the pandemic?
Well, one of the things that stands out to me is the incredible politicization of COVID on all sides that took place in 2020. You had a campaign that really came down to one side saying, you're all going to die if you don't elect us. And the other side saying, there's nothing to see here, and minimizing. And that didn't serve the American people either way. When I talk about COVID, I say we need to understand that if we don't have a healthy society, it's going to hurt us economically. It's going to hurt us from an educational standpoint. And that's why we need to lean into it. Unfortunately, with H5N1, I'm seeing us make the same mistakes all over again. You're seeing the tension between economics and health. When you have one side saying that you need to stop drinking milk and you should avoid eating meat because of H5N1 and the spread in cattle and in poultry. And then you've got other people downplaying it, saying that there's nothing to see here. And the administration has quite frankly fumbled the ball on this from a communication standpoint, from a coordination standpoint. We've got USDA, CDC, FDA. Nobody knows who's in charge. We're making the same mistakes all over again.
That book again is Crisis and Chaos, Lessons from the Front Lines of the War Against COVID-19. Dr. Jerome Adams, former U.S. Surgeon General in the Trump administration, now Executive Director at Purdue University Health Equity Initiatives. Great to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. On December 14th, 2010, U.S. Border Patrol agent Brian Terry was killed in the line of duty in Arizona. The investigation exposed the ATF's botched Operation Fast and Furious. This week, I'm joined by retired ATF Deputy Assistant Director Peter Forselli as he discusses how he became a whistleblower and the lengths he had to go through to clear his name for telling the truth. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Subscribe to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Tommy Lahren.
What's on your mind?
In her forthcoming book, No Going Back, The Truth on What's Wrong with Politics and How We Move America Forward, South Dakota governor and rumored potential Trump running mate Kristi Noem details a shocking and disturbing incident wherein she shot and killed her 14-month-old hunting dog. When I saw the headline, I thought there's no way this can be true, but then I read the passage and sure enough, it's all right there. Noem wrote about what a bad hunting dog Cricket was and how he wanted to play instead of perform his duties. She also wrote about how she hated the dog and was mortified when he killed a neighbor's chickens. So what did she do? She shot him. The story was supposed to highlight how Noem is unafraid to make hard decisions, and to say that didn't land is a major understatement. As a South Dakotan, as a dog lover, as a decent human being, I am thoroughly embarrassed. I'm Tommy Lahren, and you can watch my show Tommy Lahren is Fearless at Outkick.com.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at FoxNewsPodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to FoxNews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.